The Shaggy Jenkins Show.
We have to make Russia great again.
On the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome to it. Today, we'll be talking about Michael Cohen and his secrets. Robert Mueller is still an employee of the Department of Justice, and that could make things pretty interesting. The latest developments in the big trade war that is sending stocks, well, down, down, down. And we'll also talk about, ramping up of escalations with Iran today. Before we get to all of that, I should run through all of the things that, well, this show is about. First, you can find us on our website at ShaggyJenkins.com, wherever fine social media is served at Shaggy Live. And, oh good, if you're really, really just hankering for some old episodes, you can always check out any of our archives on either archive.org or wherever fine podcasting is served. Just look for the Shaggy Jenkins Show. We begin today, well, I should say, before we begin today, I would like to kind of touch upon a little bit of a parental story. And this has to do with YouTube. Okay, not too long ago, there was a YouTube star by the name of Austin Jones. Now, he just built up a massive fan base around doing cover songs of pop. You know, pop music, things like that. The same stuff that Justin Bieber got famous for. Except, unlike Justin Bieber, who, let's just all agree, hasn't been the most upstanding citizen in his past, he never went this far. You see, Austin Jones, through his fandom, kind of grew his own personal underage harem of teenage girls. And using, well, psychological abuse and just being able to get inside of their head because he was so super famous to them, well, teenage girl after teenage girl after teenage girl fell victim to him. Now, the 26-year-old had some half a million subscribers on YouTube. And about 225,000 on Twitter. Both of those accounts are now deleted. YouTube blocked his channel from carrying advertisement following his arrest in 2017. But get this, up until his conviction, still kept Jones' account online. Now, some of the things that he was, well, guilty of was production and receipt of child pornography. And also just basically using psychological abuse to get underage girls to submit to his whims. Now, the reason I bring this story up is because it might not be apparent to you, but if you have children that are teenagers, if you have kids that are kind of preteens, guys, if you still watch Netflix, if you still watch television at all, no matter where it's manufactured, unless it's manufactured in short form for YouTube, you're not seeing the future here. You see, as time goes on, aggregate services like a YouTube will become the norm of how we consume everything from information to entertainment to original content. Now, the thing about all of that is that we have to be very, very careful because, as we saw with the Harvey Weinstein case, look, even institutions like Hollywood that actually are supposed to have rules and safeguards in place can still kind of house some very creepy undercurrents inside of its culture, and that is so true of YouTube itself. It's not just the fact that this one star was found guilty of this. We could go through a litany of YouTube stars that have been convicted of some pretty serious crimes. And if you're not paying attention to the whole YouTube phenomenon, then, like I said, you don't realize where the future of entertainment is coming from and why it's probably important that we all start to have conversations with each other, with our kids, with our parents, with each other about where and how this kind of content is going to be disseminated. The reason why is because I know, everybody is so in love with the devil-may-care blasé attitude of post anything and just let it go viral. But let's not forget, that kind of led to the outbreak of measles in this country, the reemergence of the Flat Earth Society. The list could go on of all the crazy stuff that unchecked media consumption brings in. And that's where a story like Austin Jones kind of has like a sick twist to it, and especially for me, because I kind of went through a similar, well, I didn't go through the scandal. I was on a channel that had a guy convicted of a sexual assault and who would not take down his content. So me being on that channel, along with a bunch of other shows way back in the day, left the platform. It's kind of where I got my internet notoriety from. Fun fact, if you actually look up anything around the whole John Hawk scandal and you notice some videos from Ron Pertee, well, you'll see that me and him have known each other quite a long while. But that's just it. As an entertainer on a platform that had somebody that was basically still being used to elicit views, even though that they had been alleged to have done some pretty despicable things. And let's not forget, those despicable things ended up to being like some 30-something videos and nude pictures of underage girls and in separate encounters where, like said, psychological abuse techniques and things like that, some really gnarly stuff, was employed by Austin Jones against these girls. Now, here's the thing. I'm not going to advocate, you know, any sort of YouTube censorship or anything like that. Nor am I going to say, oh, parents, don't let your kids go on YouTube, because that, at the end of the day, is wrong. Look, the world is changing and we need to go ahead and adapt with those changes. And this Austin Jones story from YouTube says that we definitely need to have a little bit more scrutiny when it comes to anybody willy-nilly from anywhere being able to elicit a lot of viewers and what they're going to do with those viewers. Let's not forget, YouTube and, well, other video servicing platforms also led to the rise of people like, well, guys that thought kids were crisis actors in the Sandy Hook massacre, Alex Jones. And if we're going to have platforms where these kind of devious people can rise to power, then we also need to have some sort of, oh God, here's that word that we don't like in our modern democracy, checks and balances against something going awry. And in the case of Austin Jones, YouTube knew that it was going crazy and still kept his content up after he was already arrested on charges. Something to consider, huh? Well, let's talk about people that are being arrested that have, like, can we say just mysterious overtones to them? Look, Michael Cohen yesterday had a bizarre press conference. And I took the time to listen to it and everything. I watched it just probably like many of you and just kind of scratched my head and said, is something weird here? The reason I bring that up is because, look, first, Michael Cohen said something that is kind of striking. He says, quote, I hope that when I rejoin my family and friends, that the country will be in a place without xenophobia, injustice, and lies at the helm of our country. Okay, so stop the presses right there. We have to consider he's going to jail for 3 years. That means that he's getting out after the next presidential election. And whether or not his life is allowed to return to some sort of sense of normalcy, which, if you explore his past record, is, well, let's just say that good luck on finding normalcy, Michael Cohen. But if it's still a President Donald Trump when he gets out of prison, his life could be much more hard to deal with, hard to even go on. Hell, there might even be an effort to keep him in prison. You never know. But that's why Michael Cohen's press conference was a little surreal. Now, let's not forget that last week he did go to prosecutors in his trial, in his case, and basically said, hey, can we have another meeting before jail? I got some stuff that I want to unload real quick. And of course, prosecutors said, see you in 3 years, buddy. Little too late kind of scenario happening here. So they, of course, turned down the meeting. And that's when Michael Cohen announced his press conference. Now, the weekend, all the media sat around with bated breath going, ooh, what kind of savory bits would come out of Michael Cohen's mouth? And instead of something savory, something mysterious came out. And I'll explore the mystery of that in just a sec. But here's the quote. Quote, there still remains much to be told, and I look forward to the day where I can share the truth. End quote. Now, that is basically the last things he said before he started his like football run through a crowd of media personality, ignoring their questions and stuff. Jumped into a Cadillac, and then that's where, well, he took a ride up to the Federal Correction Institution that he's going to be serving his 3-year sentence. Now, here's the thing about the context of that quote. I was actually trying to do some real deep digging on this and figure out why that statement exists. And you're probably thinking, well, Shaggy, it's Michael Cohen. It's one of Trump's lackeys. Of course, he's going to say something outlandish and weird just to kind of get this reaction. Okay, so he's going to do this reactionatory kind of statement thing, you know, hoopla, hoopla. And then he's going to go to jail, come out, write a book, write a movie, and everything's going to be great, right? I don't think it's that simple. You see, the thing that I was talking about actually has to do with legality. When Michael Cohen took his plea agreement, one of the things that hasn't really been made public or discussed about a whole lot is he under a non-disclosure or what we would like to call in the literal world, a gag order? Can Michael Cohen actually talk about things? And here's where it's surprising. I couldn't find one. I really tried to find something that said, legally, Michael Cohen is not allowed to talk until X amount of time has transpired, blah, 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 you know, legalese stuff, but I couldn't find it. And then that brought me to the second kind of conclusion. If somebody tells you that they're in a situation where they cannot tell you the full truth, it probably means that Michael Cohen is, okay, here's the crazy thing. He might be doing the mob informant kind of, they're going to kill me, but I've got information on them, see? See? And as long as I have that information, I'm going to be safe in the slammer, see? So there is one part of that that is kind of, you know, Al Capone-ish, as Donald Trump likes to reference some weird bootleggers in Chicago. But yeah, just like a lackey of Al Capone, Michael Cohen does seem to be doing that. I've got it. I got dirt on you, see? So don't come after me. And that could be one of the motivations for it. Because, once again, I tried to find some sort of legal exclusion. Some sort of thing that said Michael Cohen cannot talk. And I couldn't find one. And that leads us to the other thing. Well, remember how I jokingly said, what if this was all about a movie and a book? You see, clever marketeers would actually kind of tell him, look, no matter what, just tell people at a press conference right before prison that they've got a lot more to expect from you. So after you do your time at Otisville, which is, you know, minimum security, it's been called Club Fed, by the way. But after you do your 3 years there, we'll come out and then we'll be like, remember 3 years ago when Michael Cohen had a mystery? Well, if the situation works out right, we're in a new country with a new president and a new political paradigm, and here's all of this old dirt that, by that time, people in power won't have as much of an influence over the future and fate of Michael Cohen. Now, this is the thing, too. When somebody comes out and says there still remains much to be told, and you know that they failed in a meeting with prosecutors, you also wonder if, and here's another scenario for you, during the time that Michael Cohen will be serving, you know, there's this whole thing called an appeals process. What if that truth that remains to be told is his secret, pardon the term here, trump card? You know, the thing that could actually get him out of jail free. The part that he is going to reveal only in an appeal of his current sentence that will grant him some sort of leverage or some sort of, guess what we would call judicial mercy. But see, that's just it. With all of the various investigations around Donald Trump, nobody wanted to talk to Cohen in the 11th hour. And they've had plenty of opportunity since his whirlwind testimony in front of the House. Now, his legal team has asked House Democrats to kind of jump in with prosecutors after he did that testimony. But, of course, with it being an election year, and I don't know why this matters when we're talking about the foundation of the principles of the concept of our country. But because it's a political year, a lot of Democrats were like, you know what? We're not going to help. And the reason we're not going to help is because it would look bad on us politically. And that's kind of the answer that his legal team, Michael Cohen's that is, received. Now, here's the thing. With the Trump Organization writing time and time and time again, and, well, Trump himself, calling Michael Cohen a buffing, boasting New Yorker, calling him a rat, calling him all kinds of names, a lone wolf, constantly seeking the boss's approval. This is all things that have been said about Michael Cohen. With all of these things out there, Cohen could be holding on to something just because it could still get him in further trouble. You see, with all of those various investigations, Cohen had a lot to do with them as Trump's legal counsel. He has his name on a lot of those forms. A lot of them. And as the investigations into Trump's financial records, which we'll talk about in a little bit, they're going just great. With all of that stuff happening, Cohen could actually kind of be culpable in another crime. So the fifth reason that I could think of why Michael Cohen is keeping his silence is that he could actually have something on somebody else, but he would have to plead the fifth on how he knows these things, but he might be culpable in those actions as well. Now, keep in mind, you know, he pled guilty to lying to Congress. That's bad. He pled guilty to a lot of other stuff. That's bad. When he came out for his testimony, all of a sudden, America was ready to give him a pass because he had a little nugget of, well, the inner workings of Trump, including how Trump uses his payoff schemes of do it in cash, do it in cash, do it in cash, to make illicit affairs with two former porn actresses. Okay, one former porn star and a current porn actress. Make those go away. Pay them in cash was the quote that Michael Cohen got on tape for everyone to hear. So it's going to be weird. In about 3 years' time, no matter the truth that Michael Cohen holds on to, it's going to be very odd to see what the consequences of those actions will be, of coming out with the truth. Will it exonerate Michael Cohen as the whistleblower that a lot of people really want him to be, despite the fact that, once again, he's been party to some pretty slimy acts for a pretty long time? So the redemption of Michael Cohen may never come around full circle. But as he entered into prison for a 3-year sentence, there is one thing that is not mysterious. Michael Cohen is hedging his bets that Donald Trump will not be president by the time his term is up. That is, honestly, one of the biggest statements that you can make about this whole situation. Because, part of it all, these two have axes to grind with each other. There is some major, we're talking Iowa caucus size beef between these two. And there is a deep history of a lot of conversations that you and I may never know of, but are fully ensconced in the brain of one Michael Cohen. And with him hedging his bets of, I will go to prison, and by the time I get out, Donald Trump will be out. It's almost like he's saying, hey, look, you know what? Hopefully, we'll be in a better place as a country. And the sad thing is I don't think Michael Cohen realized that when he says something like that, right? When he says, I hope that the country isn't so hate-directed and things like that, we do kind of have to take a look back at his own Twitter shenanigans when he said that he would save a prison cell for Hillary Clinton and, well, all kinds of other stuff that Michael Cohen has been saying online, just like his boss, at the time, Donald Trump. It's going to be very difficult for history to edit out some of those things that he's done. And the problem with that is that in a time like this, when you have two political parties, one that is absolutely capitulating behind its leader, no matter what kind of weird directive he takes them, and two, another party, not so quite as powerful in the legislative branch as they need to be to accomplish their goals, but who is determined to dig in their heels and not impeach him, the president that is, because it will make them look bad in front of a political race. And let's not forget that when it comes to the, and we'll talk about this in just a bit with Mayor Pete and stuff, but electability is something that's on the table for all the candidates on the Democratic side. And one of the things that they think right now, and I'm wondering if it's foolishly, they think right now that if they move towards impeachment, people who could potentially vote for them would see them as being fear-mongering, as engaging in presidential harassment, as being guilty of the party of, no, we're not going to cooperate. They actually see their constitutional role as oversight for the executive branch as politically disadvantageous. So if you're one of those people that's kind of scratching your heads and you're going, well, look, I'm looking back at the Richard Nixon timeline, and by the time that he had already done the Saturday Night Massacre, Donald Trump attempted one, but it didn't go as planned. After the Saturday Night Massacre, that's when things ramped up in the legislative branch, and then, boom, we were into Watergate. Remember, when Watergate happened, the election, the big election, the presidential election, was in the past. It was in their rearview mirror. And this time, what's happening is, instead of having the benefit of not being in a politically delicate situation, we're instead trapped with two parties that don't want to make any sort of move versus obstruction and ramp up investigation. Nobody wants to move the hand closer or further away from impeachment only because they're afraid of what me and you will think. And that is, dare I say, kind of scary and silly. Nancy Pelosi has actually came out and made a lot of statements about how she is not for impeachment right now. And behind the scenes, it seems that a lot of people are saying the reasoning for that is she doesn't want to saddle Democrats right now with being the sourpuss party. She doesn't want Democrats to develop this repertoire of just being angry at Trump the man. But keep in mind, Trump is free to be as angry as he wants. As a matter of fact, he came out and said, well, because the Democrats took 2 years of my presidency with this Mueller investigation, I should have 2 extra years to be president. He actually, well, first he retweeted that from Jerry Falwell, but then he came out and said it himself. Now, everybody around the president scrambled and said, he's joking. But let's not forget, every time the president makes a joke like this, he eventually attempts to do some sort of action towards it. I'm not saying the president is going to go after two more. I'm totally saying the president might try to do that. He's Trump. And at this point, when we're having this debate about whether or not we're going to impeach him, Michael Cohen's truths remain to be told. Could have consequences, but we may never know because nobody wants to take that first move towards impeachment for fear of political retribution. When we get back, we'll talk about more. Up next, it's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
Is the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back. Hey, if you missed any part of the first part of our show, then, well, shame on you. You should probably check out our podcast. It's everywhere. Just look for us on Spotify, on iTunes, on Anchor FM, on Caster. Look, we're basically everywhere. Just look for the Shaggy Jenkins Show. We're even on Patreon. Hey, I am your host, a critical thinker, guy just left of normal insane, but always centered in common sense. My name is, well, Shaggy Jenkins. That's what the show's named after, right? You can find me at my website, shaggyjenkins.com, or wherever fine social media is served, at Shaggy Live. Now, let's get into a very interesting case here. Before we went to the break, we were talking about a lawyer named Michael Cohen. And as we talked about some of the things that he's been involved with, he basically made mention that for years and years and years, he was the sidekick to Donald Trump doing all of his legal dirty work. Well, now, after last Thursday's refusal to show up in his, requested hearing, it looks like Bill Barr has now put himself firmly in Donald Trump's fixer camp. And it gets weirder than just the Democrats going after him with a contempt charge, with him refusing to show up, with him objecting to the forum that they were going to do this all in, and the questions, and it was his decision and his decision alone, so case closed, he's the attorney general, move on. These are things that an empowered Michael Cohen would have done, and it's kind of scary, okay, but it's kind of weird to see that the attorney general is now putting himself firmly in the role of Donald Trump's fixer. Excuse me. Get a little choked up when I talk about judicial misgivings of attorney generals. Here's the thing, though, and this is a very interesting debate. Over the weekend, Donald Trump, in his ravenous tweet storm, kind of tossed out the whole, I don't think Mueller should testify. Now remember, the House has said that Bob Mueller, the writer of the report, was supposed to loosely show up in their chambers around May 15th for a little bit of a hearing on what happened during the course of his investigation. There is a problem with that, and the president's tweet actually clued us in on what that problem is. You see, after the investigation was over. Robert Mueller was actually expected to step down, to leave his post at the Department of Justice. But here's the thing. He's still an employee, and when pressured by the media to respond, hey, what happened to Robert Mueller stepping down? They won't say. And that is going to complicate things incredibly. You see, with Bill Barr now being Donald Trump's fixer in chief, he's the attorney fixer. Or the attorney general fixer? Attorney of general fixery. There we go. With him as the official attorney general of fixery, Bill Barr can actually bar... okay, that's not punny. He can bar Mueller from showing up. See, Mueller is still an employee of the Justice Department. And since he now is being called by the House to testify, the Department of Justice can say no, just like we kept William Barr from testifying on that Thursday meeting, so too can we refuse to allow Mueller. Now remember, Donald Trump calls this a redo. He says over the weekend, Bob Mueller should not testify. No redo for the Dems. But this isn't a redo. You see, Barr skipped out on answering questions that were in-depth about the Mueller report. So, given the fact that the Attorney General, the person that is supposed to be the highest overseer of that whole operation, refuses to answer questions about the subject and manner in that report, the next best logical step is find the person who wrote the report. This is logical thinking, people. It works great. But when you try to do that with Bob Mueller still an employee of the Department of Justice, you have a big problem on your hand. The president tweeted it. And remember how I said earlier, look, don't take any of his craziness for granted. When the president says something crazy on his Twitter page, gauging the reaction that he gets, he sometimes uses those things in policy. They are not just crazy, rambling things. So when he came out and said Bob Mueller should not testify, no redo for the Dems, look at the amount of his base that went crazy over it. And of course, all of the Russian bots and stuff that are on Twitter. Millions of accounts, a lot of them following Donald Trump. Going to leave it at that. The thing is with all of that uproar of, yeah, man, stick it to those Dems, there is a very good chance that the president could call a favor to the attorney general and then make sure that Mueller can't appear. Now, I know what you're thinking, but, Shaggy, there's already this huge fight about to happen. The Democrats went after Trump's tax returns. Steve Mnuchin said no, because of reasons, and I'll get into that in just a sec. And now there is going to be a legal fight in the courts already between the Trump administration and the House of Representatives. There's already going to be a big fight in that arena. So what would benefit Trump and Barr from just saying no testimony from Mueller? Well, of course, they get to say, no, we're sticking to our line in the sand kind of toughness in hopes that it will drum up enough support so that 2020 is kind to us. And, you know, Trump gets his second term. However, what if, God forbid, William Barr, who is by no stretch of the imagination a political dummy, what if Barr does something even more devious? What if he can allow Mueller to testify, but restrict the content and the direction that he can testify in? Because as a Justice Department employee, they can actually handle the request of whether or not he even appears, and they can also well, determine the amount of testimony he is allowed to give. Now, I know what you're saying. The easy solution is, hey, Bob Mueller, retire already. Problem. The Department of Justice will not answer questions of why he's still on the payroll when clearly he intended to step down from the very beginning of his start as a special prosecutor immediately after the investigation was over. Mueller is not a young man. He feels that he's done his public service. He is ready to tap out. But instead, he's still on payroll, and that could complicate things incredibly. Now, this is the reason that one little side story there about Mueller still being on the payroll is kind of a huge deal. You see, last week, in finally coming forward with a formal announcement, the Trump White House said, hey, on Monday, we're going to tell the Dems to stuff it. And that's exactly what they did. Monday, they basically went to the House and said, you know what, through Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, he says, the demand for these records, quote, lacks a legitimate legislative purpose of, okay, can I just stop right there? That would, by the way, the House Ways and Means Committee, which is handled by Richard Neal of Massachusetts, they're the ones that made this request looking for 6 years of Donald Trump's personal and business tax return. Mnuchin came out and said their, quote, lacks a legitimate legislative purpose. Can we rewind the clock a little bit? Remember that guy I was talking about at the first part of the show? Michael Cohen? That statement from Steve Mnuchin is factually incorrect. And we can thank the new representative from New York, the notorious AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, actually set the precedent in a very legal binding way for a legitimate legislative purpose for looking into Trump's business and personal finances. And it happened during Cohen's testimony. Think back to it. That weird, weird day when everybody was wondering whether or not we should root for the bad guy or root for the kind of medium guy or what kind of guy was he? We don't know. But when everybody was mesmerized by the stuff coming out of Michael Cohen's mouth, Representative Ocasio-Cortez took her time to actually set up a case-by-case need, legitimate need, and purpose for looking into Trump's tax records. And it had to do with her line of questioning about whether or not the president has purposely underreported or overreported his assets to insurance companies, to financial companies, to even Deutsche Bank, which, by the way, Donald Trump sued to make sure that they won't turn over any records either. You see where this is going? Everything that Michael Cohen said to Ocasio-Cortez basically set the precedent for we need to look into his tax records. Did the president ever willfully underreport his value? Yes. Do we need to see his tax returns to verify that data? Yes. Boom. In two lines, you have a legitimate purpose. Now, you're probably thinking, well, so what? Trump lies about his value all the time. I mean, even at the beginning of his candidacy, people were talking about Trump's net worth is actually a reflection of how he feels that day. It has nothing to do with some sort of spreadsheet and actual numbers. No, if Trump feels like he's the richest man in America, which he did at the start of his campaign, that's what he reported he was. But you see, when it comes to talking to insurance companies, when it comes to talking to city planners, especially when it comes to the golf course that is in Representative Ocasio-Cortez's district that Donald Trump owns and has, let's just say, some wild kind of a setup where Donald Trump got the city to pay for the golf course, but he gets to take all the profits for 4 years. He did that by underreporting the value of that establishment and how much money it makes vis-a-vis the charge of fraud. And when you're looking into a claim of fraud, that, unfortunately, for Steve Mnuchin, is a legitimate legislative purpose for the request of these records. Now, this kind of brings up this interesting fight on two fronts scenario, because the House Judiciary Committee is going to go forward with their contempt vote against the Attorney General. And here's the thing. The Justice Department last night agreed to having a staff-level meeting on Tuesday to kind of fight that back, but they're still going forward with it. And when it comes to the tax precedent that everybody is talking about on this front, will it be as big of a fight as it is right now against Barr to get the full, unredacted Mueller report? It probably will be much, much worse. Because let's not forget, not only did Michael Cohen set up the precedents for this whole legitimate legislative purpose of looking into Donald Trump's tax returns, not only did he set up that precedence, he also, right before he went to jail, alluded to the fact that that could be even deeper a mystery than we currently know. And since nobody's going to put those pieces together, well, who knows? In 3 years, he might come out with a different president in the United States and say, ha 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 ha, let me tell you how I screwed your country. Now, Trump did not release his tax returns when he was a candidate. And he said that he did that because he was under an audit. And it was an immense, complicated thing being under an audit. And he can't talk about it because he's under an audit. And then the IRS came out and said, we're not auditing him. We have no idea what he's talking about. Nobody is auditing Donald Trump. And so the next story became, well, this is all just political infighting, and it's just the Democrats trying to have gotcha moments with my tax returns. They're looking for things between me and the Russians, and it's like, no. Remember, collusion is not a charge. Obstruction of justice is. And in the case of Michael Cohen's testimony that Ocasio-Cortez got him to admit on record during a hearing, evidence of actual legitimate fraud could be in those tax returns from the president, either under-evaluating his properties and assets or over-evaluating them to serve the purpose of either getting loans, securing funding, or dodging taxes, which, once again, the president knows to do that in hundreds of millions of dollars, according to, well, a lot of journalism that came out, especially that one that came out in the New York Times. Now, here's the thing. When you look at all these various fights, okay, let's go back to the Barr fight real quick. Gerald Nadler, okay, Jerry Nadler, he's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He said yesterday, Congress must see the full report and underlying evidence to determine how to best move forward with oversight, legislation, and other constitutional responsibility. That constitutional responsibilities that he's talking about is making sure that your president isn't a tax cheat. It's kind of one of those things that we assumed that we would never have to have a debate over, but guess what? We're having a debate over now. And if anything, that kind of shows you how far gone down the rabbit hole we are. Now, this is the thing. When it comes to Nadler, he's basically saying, there's a failure to comply here. We issued a subpoena. We've tried to make accommodation efforts. But because he just outright did not show up and told us no, we're going to go after and say that he is in contempt of a subpoena in front of the House of Legislation. Now, there's Doug Collin. You know him. He's the top Republican on the committee. He says that all of this stuff is illogical, disingenuous. It's a proxy war. It's all about smearing the Attorney General. because, get this, because they can't get to the president. Because they're not mad, they can't get to the president, and that Bob Mueller didn't give them the tomahawk chop of being able to take the president's head off. Because of all of that stuff, this is really just a proxy war, and we're going to go after William Barr because we can't go after anybody else. Oh, woe is us, Democrat. Remember, it's not that at all. As much as the Republicans, and specifically the president, try to besmirch these investigations, we have to keep our eyes on the logical horizon. Why are we looking into this? Is it really about politics? No, it isn't. It's about transparency, something that we used to laud politicians for doing good in the past. And remember that one time in our country when a president wasn't so transparent? That was Richard Nixon. Watergate happened, and we pretty much tried to stay away from that until we elected Trump. And now we're at a point of our country where Watergate is not going to even begin to serve as a watermark anymore for what is happening with the Trump administration. Because a contempt vote may sound, ooh, oh, they're going to hold the attorney general in contempt. But get this, at the end of the day, that's just basically like saying, you're a bad man. Wag our finger at you, Mr. Bad Man. That's it. It's symbolic at best. It is legally nothing. You see, for William Barr to actually have to face criminal charges, the entire House, including Republicans, would first have to even approve charges against him. Now, Eric Holder, who served under President Barack Obama, was held in contempt by the Republican-controlled House for a botched attempt to crack illegal guns. You remember that? The Fast and Furious thing? Okay, but he was the first sitting attorney general held in contempt of Congress. But guess what? The Justice Department never pursued charges against him. And if you think the Department of Justice, now, with Rosenstein leaving and everybody kind of making as fast tracks as they can to get out, do you think that's going to happen? Probably not. Probably not. Because even if the entire House came together and said, yes, this contempt charge needs to be levied against the Attorney General, there's a good chance that the Justice Department, who would actually be in charge of issuing a warrant, a subpoena, and any other legally binding actions, the Justice Department would then go, psst. And I know it's weird that I'm using a Democratic administration to show you the precedents for this, but that's exactly what happened to Eric Holder. The House came out and said, hey, we hold you in contempt. The Department of Justice said, meh, who cares? Our rules, and we don't have to enforce them. Neener, neener. Boy. You know, the thing is I've got like two more stories I wanted to get in today, and unfortunately, I think I'm going to have to drop the story talking about Mayor Pete saying that he really wants to fight Donald Trump in, get this, a debate about marriage and values and who has actually the best effect on traditional marriage in the United States. But I have to drop that story because, look, I've only got a couple of minutes here and we've got to cover what's going on to Iran. Okay, here's the thing. John Bolton, the war dog that he is, said that in response to a number of troubling and escalatory indications and warnings that they are sending the USS Abraham Lincoln to go warn Iran not to do anything else. Now, they're putting out a strike group, they're putting out a bomber task force, and they're doing this all because Iran is basically, how do I say this, an enemy of Donald Trump. Now, this is the thing. Mike Pompeo told reporters, it is absolutely the case that we've seen escalatory actions from the Iranian. He did not even explain what those actions were. Now, keep in mind, Pompeo, unlike Bolton, said that they have good reason to want to communicate about how the Iranians should understand how we will respond and actions they may take. In other words, hey, you know what? As tough talking as I'm sounding now, diplomacy is something, at least from Pompeo, that seems to still be in the cards. When it comes to Bolton, on the other hand, escalatory actions, undefined, not even talked about, not even, like, we really have to concern ourselves with metrics in this country. What is the standard for an action? When it comes to a governmental action, especially when it comes to escalating tensions between countries that, let's not forget, just 3 years ago we were actually celebrating de-escalation of tensions between our two countries. Now we are back at war, or at least at proxy wars with each other and escalating. But when it comes to those escalatory actions, those ramping up of tensions by Iran against the United States, I have yet to find some that can be defined in a metric that would be like, that constitutes some sort of military action. Now, last year, Donald Trump pulled us out of the nuclear agreement. Iran was going to limit its nuclear activities, allow in international inspectors. It was going to receive a lot of relief and sanctions. In the sanctions that it had, and also be able to open its markets up to foreign trade in a lot of markets that were emerging, and especially for Iran, a country that depends on actually needing to export its goods. This was a huge, huge deal. So when the White House left, the rest of the world said, oh my God, they're crazy. So China, India, Japan, South Korea, and Turkey, they're still buying Iranian oil. The UK has come out and said, those Yanks are a little crazy. And they said, no, they're staying in the accord. And the U.S. blacklisted the Revolutionary Guard Corps. That's Iran's fighting force. They designated it as a foreign terrorist group. And here's the thing. When you look at all of the reasoning behind Donald Trump's hatred for the Iranian deal, it was because Barack Obama did it. That's it. That's it. And all he's been wanting to do since that day is get a new deal that he can put the Trump name on. That's not a joke. Put his name on that supersedes the deal that Barack Obama made. Because he hates Obama. This whole escalatory actions things that Mike Pompeo is talking about and John Bolton is acting on, those escalatory actions may not actually be from Iran, people. It might be us escalating it because Donald Trump desperately wants to bring Iran back to the table. He wants to compel them, to force them into a new deal. And that new deal, of course, would carry the Trump name and would be so much better than Obama's deal, right? But that's what this is all over. Have we seen an escalatory action? No. Have we seen some motivations for Trump to kind of compel them to negotiate? Yeah, afraid so. Till the next time, love you, mean it. Kaden, bye.